Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Cinema Sommelier, where, of course, we taste test movies. I'm Gary T. Moore.
And I'm Zachary Washaleski. And today we're here to talk about 2018's Ari Aster film, Hereditary. So Hereditary is a film that it's actually Ari Aster's first feature-length film.
Wow.
And it's essentially, spoiler alert, there will be a lot of those. It's essentially a film of family drama is essentially the genre that he tries to go for. It's kind of psychological horror, Rosemary's Baby-esque. Like, there's a lot of things like that. But it follows this family who essentially goes through tragedy after tragedy. It starts with the grandmother's funeral and basically goes downhill from there from the very beginning and spirals into the witchcraft cult, trying to possess a body for a demon. And it's just this family's hard times. I don't know if, Gary, you want to add anything to that?
No, yeah, that's right. It basically takes. I like how you said family drama. Like, I like how that was like, if you're looking for a good family drama, look no further than Ari Aster's Hereditary. No, it does. It definitely. It's a different, completely different kind of family drama. But at its core, it focuses on a family, and I mean, it's Hereditary. You know, it's called Hereditary for a reason because it sticks within this family, and I think that it's. I would love to know someone's take just like looking at like, oh, here's a movie called Hereditary, or like seeing the cover, maybe, like the movie
right.
cover, which is still, you know, terrifying. It's still terrifying. I mean, just Toni Collette's like void of expression on the cover. It's like, wow. And then who's this little girl? And like, what is she all about? I know you have a lot to say, and I have a lot to say. It's going to be a roller coaster of an episode, and I'm very excited to dive in. So,
one last thing. So I did take a note in my research, and I saw how Ari Aster actually described it, which he called it a story about a long-lived possession ritual told from the perspective of the sacrificial lamb. And I think that is such a perfect description of this movie. He also calls it a family tragedy that curdles into a nightmare. Like, those are like, that is so spot on how that movie feels. I'm excited to talk about this one.
Yeah, because it's what? It's from the point of view of Peter, right?
Yep.
And everything that he's kind of, oh, this poor guy. Yeah, you go ahead. You go ahead. I will.
Yep.
You go ahead. Yeah.
So the acting in this movie is phenomenal. I know you already talked, Toni Collette's in it. Alex Wolff plays Peter. The father is phenomenal. Even the girl who really is a staple of the marketing. Like, she's just heavy in all the trailers for this. She's on the posters. Millie Shapiro is her name. She plays Charlie, who's like a 13-year-old girl who has like something wrong. Like, you know that there's like something going on mm-hmm. with her throughout the movie. And I think she plays it so well. And going through watching this movie the first time, there's just an uneasiness to everything.
Oh my God.
Right?
I was anxious the entire 2 hours I was sitting down watching this movie. For the second time.
Was this the first time you saw it? Okay.
No, this is still only my second time. So I'm like, and I hadn't rewatched it since I watched it, you know, when it first came out. And I'm like, because like, I know what happens and it's so anxiety driven. And,
yep.
But it was so wonderful to revisit because it was still a new movie. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not like, oh, of course this is where this happens. But like, just the score that drives the anxiety in you. I'm just like, oh my God. Like, I'm sitting on the couch. Like, I don't, like, I'm breathing heavy when Charlie starts breathing. It's so like, oh, it's so influential when it comes to how you feel. I think.
I think Ari Aster has this tendency to make a movie better viewing it the second time, because it was the same way for Midsommar, his second feature film. It's the exact same thing for me. Like, I watched it the first time and I walked out of the theaters being like, what did I just watch? Like, I genuinely, I didn't know. Like, I couldn't comprehend everything that was going on. And then you watch it the second time and you're like, I figured it out. So just to go into like what basically happens is like, essentially in the film, again, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it and you really want to see this movie, I highly recommend it. Go watch it now.
Please.
But what happens is like, the grandmother in this family basically puts a curse on her own family and says, we want to summon this demon of wealth and knowledge to come to Earth.
King Paimon
was his name. We want to summon him to come back, take the place of a body that will be in my family. If from the perspective of the grandmother, we'll take the body of one of the males in my family and you'll reward us with riches. So in this movie, essentially, Charlie is, from my perspective at least, from birth, possessed by the spirit of this King Paimon, but he wants a male body, but he's just like buying his time in Charlie. Like, that's why there's always something eerie and off. Like, she cuts the head off of a bird at one point. Like, she's just weird. Like, she's just got this aura of like something's wrong, but no one knows why. There's not a lot of exposition in this movie. They're not explained. Like, they'll give you tidbits of like foreshadowing. Ari Aster will add that in there, but he won't tell you what's going to happen. He just gives hints at it. And then the second time you watch it, you're like, oh, of course, like that makes way more sense because now I see this. And that's how I felt viewing this again.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was watching another review about it today. And I was looking into it and I was like, oh, like this, like, so it could fill in voids that I might've missed and something like that. And they brought up the fact that Toni Collette's character builds like these miniature scale models. Right. And the way this whole movie starts is it's like this pan around this room and you see all these miniature models and they're so well done. And like it pans into, the camera goes into a model of the house, this gorgeous house that they live in. And as soon as it gets to like inside the room, seamless transition, it's like, oh, now you're in the movie. And I was reading and looking up some facts about that. And it's like, yeah, it almost seems like if we were looking for a theme or a motif, is like the people inside that house have no control of what's happening to them. And as soon as I heard that, I'm like, you know what? That makes 100% sense.
Yep. And that's what they hint at that a little bit in one of the scenes where Peter's in the classroom. They're talking about like, there's a book where basically Heracles doesn't have a choice and he dies. And it's like, oh, does that make it any more or less tragic? And like, that is just like, again, there's so many small things. Ari Aster's never going to put one thing in the movie if it isn't relevant to what's going on. And so, yeah, I think you're right. It's a throwback to one of our first movies that we did with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, where Gage was talking about like the power of choice. Like, they don't have that in this movie. Basically, everything that they do is foreshadowed, and like the cult forced them to do this. Like, again, spoiler alert, a quarter of the way through the movie, Charlie's character dies. She's decapitated by a telephone pole.
Oh, God.
Leading up to that, I mean, that sequence is my favorite. Leading up to that, there's basically the symbol of the cult on the telephone pole as they drive by. It holds on it so you can see that symbol's there. You don't quite know what that means yet. Then they go to the party. She eats walnut-filled chocolate cake. She has an allergic reaction. Her throat's swelling up. They're driving her to the hospital, or Peter's driving her to the hospital. She's freaking out. She's holding her head out the window. The killing of a sacred deer, I suppose, is what caused this. He swerves around it, and she just crunches her face against the telephone pole. It was so visceral. But what I love is they don't show anything. Like, they just focus on Peter. The whole time, he's just – I cannot imagine being in that position. Being in his position, knowing what just happened, he glances back and he's like, I'm just going to go. I'm going home.
I don't know what I tried to put myself a little bit. I'm not going to go all the way into that, but like, I tried to put myself in that position a little bit. I'm like, I don't know what me as a person would do if something like that just happened. Because, like, you have to be in such a state of shock that right. you just can't function. Like, I've received plenty of bad news in my life, and I just, you know, you try to control it, you breathe it in, whatever, whatever. But, like, when something happens, like, if you're in, like, a car accident, right? Every time I'm in a car accident, I just, fortunate, like, nothing has been crazy or whatever. You sit there and you just try to take it in, whatever, whatever. And I imagine I might have the same reaction, but then too, like, I think I would find myself getting out of the car and seeing what would happen, or checking the back seat, or, because there's this little moment, there's this little tiny baby moment where he, like, says to himself, "Are you okay?" Look, like, asking Charlie in the back seat.
Yep.
And he doesn't say it loud enough for him to hear because he knows her fate. And it's just so, like, God, so freaking powerful. Like, those moments when he's just sitting there staring at the camera, or staring into the void that is the camera, and the emotion and the processing in his face and eyes and brain, you just see it all. And it's insanely powerful and vulnerable. And God, give that kid an Oscar. I don't know if you won anything. Right. I don't know if
I don't believe anybody did, which is wildly absurd to me that no one from this movie got any kind of recognition for how amazing they were. But yeah, like the build up to that, even with them basically speeding down the highway, trying to get, like, Charlie's gasping for air in the backseat. Like, it's building this tension. Like, it's just constantly rising. And as a viewer, like, you are just so into this moment of, like, I don't know what's going to happen next. Like, she can't possibly die. Like, is she going to suffocate in the back of this car? Nope. She doesn't suffocate in the back of the car. Boom. Like, and then it proceeds. So this is my favorite sequence of the entire movie. And it's, again, like a quarter of the way in. It leads to, like, 5 minutes of just no dialogue. It's just him sitting in a car. He slowly drives home. He gets into bed. And it holds on him. And the moment where the mom gets up in the morning and is talking, like, "Oh, I'm going to go to the store. I need to grab some milk," or whatever. And she gets out to the car, and it's just panic, just pure.
Yeah.
Oh,
I wrote that down in my notes as one of my favorite moments from the entire movie. I wrote, the scene where it just shows Peter's face over the audio of her finding out what happened is, oh my God, just mind blowing. Just so, because, like, you know what's going to happen. You don't know how it's going to happen. And then it just happens. Yep. And it's like, oh my God. And then the next scene is her just losing her freaking mind. I mean, she just lost her mom, right? Now she loses her 13-year-old daughter, and she's not having a good relationship with her son. And this isn't making it any worse. And then her monologue later at the dinner table. Holy dinner scene. God.
Oh, man.
She just lets him have it. And I felt so bad for him. But also, like, it's almost like a cleaning of the conscience, almost. But there's still absolutely a ton of guilt between both of them. Just, and he even tries to fire back, because she's all like, "Oh my God, like, you know, how could you do this? You knew what you were doing," whatever, whatever. And then he just fires back to himself, like, you know, she didn't want to go to the party in the first place. And it's like, whoa. Oh. Like, ruin someone's life with one sentence.
Yeah.
You know?
The disconnect from this family is so evident as you watch the movie. And I kind of focused a little bit on that. Like, they all are dealing with their own suffering in their own way. Like, obviously, it focuses a lot on Peter. It focuses on his just, like, just dead to the world, I can't believe this is happening face. Like, it's just pure anxiety, pure, like, I don't know what to do in this moment anymore. And then you've got Toni Collette's character, who's just, like, hysterical the entire time.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
Freaking out. And, like, she's basically the one who's the driving force to all of the chaos that ends up ensuing. And then you've got the dad. The dad's just this support system for both of them, and trying to, like, keep things together. But he's like, "I'm falling apart. I can't do it." And it's just, beautiful.
I literally have "poor dad" in my notes.
Oh.
Because it's just his journey, just having, you know, he's got to deal with, you know, his wife just lost her mom and like all that kind of stuff. And then he's got to deal with his, you know, he loses his daughter who he already had to like take care of and all that kind of stuff. And his son and his wife fighting. He has a great relationship with his son. And I think that's what is his driving force, is his kind of like momentum and yeah. his, and it's so, God, it's so, it's such a tangled web.
Yeah. It's also what sort of disconnects Toni Collette's character as well. It's like, she just feels so disconnected. Like, this movie plays that disconnected role. Like in that sequence I talked about after the beheading, that basically every scene for like several minutes is just one person at a time. Like, you're never going to see them both together. Like, beyond the hysteric crying and the father consoling Toni Collette on the ground, which again, also heart wrenching, just terrible thing to watch.
God.
But like all of the other scenes are like the son behind the glass, and then it's the father walking to the room, and then it's Toni Collette's, like, it's just all so divided. And it plays into like, that's how the rest of this movie goes. It's just like, everyone's just so disconnected. They're not talking to each other. They're thinking Toni Collette's crazy. She's thinking that she's crazy. She's thinking that they're thinking that she's crazy. And like, it just turns into this, like, is it real? As a viewer, like, I didn't, the first time I watched it, I was just like, I don't know what's going to happen next. Cause I don't know if she actually is crazy. Like, is it just hysteria?
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, a little bit after that, you get introduced to Ann Dowd's character. Ann Dowd, who plays Joan, who at first, you know, she's just this lady at grief counseling. And then she approaches Toni Collette's car and's like, hey, sorry, I saw you leaving. You want to just have coffee? And like, she tries to build this relationship. And it's really weird because like, she's happy. And it's such a juxtaposition to literally everything else that's happening this entire 2 hours. And she's, you know, she gets her to come over and like they get to know each other. And then there's this scene where she sees her like outside of a craft store, because as we said, you know, Toni Collette's character builds these gorgeous little models of things, including the death of her daughter, which, good God.
And her mother's funeral.
The hospital visit. And I mean, they're great. I'm not saying they're not.
But I thought she was a serial killer. I think everyone was kind of thinking it.
I was like, Toni Collette, you were giving off some vibes right now. But you get to know her, and then she sees her in the parking lot of this store and is like, hey, this is crazy. But you know how I lost my son and my grandson? Well, I found a way to talk to him, and this is how. And then you see how, and you're like, oh my God, this lady is learning like voodoo and all this kind of stuff. But you slowly realize after that it's the whole cult following, that this is, you might not even see it the first time. Yep. I didn't see it the first time. I didn't see these little Easter eggs the first time. I didn't see that the chalkboard that
was in the back of the car
was in the back of the car. And she's like, this is my grandson's favorite chalkboard, and this is how he, it's like, oh, no, it ain't, lady. Like, you just bought this.
You just bought it. Oh.
And it's little things like that you don't notice. I didn't notice it.
There's even, like, earlier, it must have been, like, 5 minutes in the movie beforehand. You can see all the mail piled in their, like, mail slot in their door. And somebody, you hear the footsteps. Somebody comes up. They just slide a seance thing on top. Like, and they're not the mailman.
That doesn't work. Yeah.
Like, it. You don't realize what it is because, again, they're not telling you. There's nothing explicitly like, oh, this is the cult putting it in there. It's like, no, just somebody came and slid a seance thing on there. But then it isn't until later where you're like, oh, the cult's been in control this entire time, that everything starts flashing back to you of like, I thought, oh my gosh, this is crazy.
Yeah. And it's like the main thing you follow, at least the main thing I followed throughout the whole thing, is the symbol, right? You see the symbol, as we said, on the necklace, and you see the symbol on the pole, and you see the symbol
in blood
and on the book and all this kind of stuff. But then also there was this, I didn't pick this up until later, but you definitely know something's off when Charlie's character goes to her grandmother at the funeral and like is looking at her and stuff like that and sees the necklace. You see this guy just like oddly just smiling at her over the thing, over the casket, and it's like, what? And then apparently that guy is one of the people, one of the cult members in the house later, who was just standing there butt naked like everyone else. And it's he alone, not even in the dark, not even naked. He alone is just a terrifying individual.
Right.
Like you watch it and you're like, something is like, why would they look at this guy for like 4 seconds if he wasn't something off-putting? Are you throwing me off, Ari Aster? Or like, what is going on here?
Yep. Nope. Everything has a reason. Everything has its place. Like, there's just so many people at the funeral. Like, even in her first speech, like 20 seconds into the movie, Toni Collette's character is like, oh, there's a lot of faces that I don't know. Like, my mom would be kind of confused by it, but like, welcome, basically.
Yeah.
And so it isn't until like the end of the movie, literally you get through the entire movie and you're like, oh, it's a cult. And then you're like, that makes way more sense. But we only have a little bit of time left. Let's get to that last sequence. Like, this movie ramps up so quickly by the end.
It does.
What is your favorite part of that? Or what sort of jumps out to you as memorable or even unmemorable if there's something that you didn't like?
Well, as I said pre-show, this is two separate movies, right? Like, we paused it like an hour in last night and we're like, wait a second, this has an hour left to go. Like, you reach a thing where you're like, this could be it. It's definitely not, thank God. But if I were to say like a sequence, these are my notes. I'll just bullet point my notes. Beautifully shot. Everything I've seen by Ari Aster is always beautifully shot. It's so, it relies on nature and natural beings, right? Toni Collette is the goat. I like the Easter eggs you see, like the fact that she didn't touch the paint when it fell, and then the demon that comes in, and you start to see the demon in all these other places. You start to see payment in all these other places. But yeah, as far as favorite scenes go, the whole Peter's face collective from the wreck to when she finds out is just, it's so simple, but it's so artistically motivated and emotionally motivated, and you don't have, it's just so good. I hate not coming up with the proper descriptive terms for it, but it's just so good.
It just emotes so much information. It's the same that we say like about all the best actors. Like, you can just give so much information off without saying anything. And he does, like, just the stress of the situation for him in basically every situation. He's almost got the same face through the entire movie.
That's true.
It's perfect, right? Like, there's just so much to it that you're like, I can't even begin to imagine how you're feeling, but your face is giving off how it should be feeling. Like, just chaos. What I don't like, and I'll get into that, his crying scenes.
I hate his crying scenes. Oh my God, I hate his crying scenes so much.
I don't know where it comes from. I don't know if he's meant to cry like a small child. Maybe you do in that moment when you're just panicked and scared and like all of that. Like, he weeps like a 7-year-old would pretend to weep.
Yes, yes. So
those kind of took me out of it a little bit, especially in the second watch. But I think my favorite parts of it, especially into that final sequence, is like when Peter wakes up and basically the father has already basically burned. The mother is possessed by King Payman. And he wakes up and you just see her up in the top corner of the room in the darkness.
Ooh.
Like, that one, watching it in theaters, I remember, is just like, oh no, no. Like, we've hit horror movie now. Like, we're here.
Yeah.
And then she like runs out the room, and like, you can just hear the collective breath of everybody around you watching it just being like, this is terrible. Like, we didn't have this through the first half of the movie. Like, we had a lot of slow burn stuff, a lot of psychological. We're in horror. Like, we're in Conjuring territory at this point.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. But then there's just like, there's still these subtle cues of like you hear him walk out and like you can hear a piano chord getting ripped out of the piano in the background. Stuff like that, that I'm just like, and then the end, she's using a piano chord to just saw her head off. Again, gory, and it's just completely different feel to the movie.
Which I didn't put together is when you see King Paimon, the picture, he's got three heads, and that's where the symbol comes from. And then you get the grandmother's head, Charlie's head, and then the mother's head is the final sacrifice to complete the trilogy. And it's just like, and I also didn't realize until the second watch, when he jumps out the window as he was going to be killed by the cult. When he jumps out the window, you see his soul leave his body, or some black shadow leave his body. But then you see the light of King Paimon enter his body, and then he gets back up. And I'm just like, this is his rebirth. Because after that, he is not the same person.
Right.
He's almost stoic to say, you know, a word. I don't know if it's stoic.
It's because King Paimon had finally broken him down. He's made him weak enough to finally be like, cool, we can get rid of this guy and I can come in. I can take his place. So, oh, phenomenal. And unfortunately, we got to get to the scoring.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to go first or you want me to go first?
I can go first.
Yeah, take it away.
I'm going to make this as easy as possible. I think this movie, Ari Aster's style, his foreshadowing a lot of the time, his way to really just like take this movie's bright for 90% of the time up until that last final sequence. Like it's bright, it's green, it's filmed in Utah, but it still has this undertone of like creepy. It's a Rosemary's Baby type of movie for a lot of it. It's Conjuring at the end. Like he takes a lot of horror elements and sort of flips them upside down. And I think it's beautiful. Like it's just an absolute masterpiece. He had this whole idea in his head and he executed it really well. Out of a 1 to 100, I'll give it, let's go with the 92.
Okay. I am right there with you. Honestly, it's a mastercraft of masterpiece of its craft. Maybe I should say it that way. It's a masterpiece of its craft because it has a little something for every kind of fan, right? Of this genre. I won't say a little something for every kind of fan. But it's definitely, it's so well-rounded. It's so, like, you know, you want horror, you want a little bit of jump scares, you want gore, you want, you know, all this kind of stuff. But do you want it based in a fantastic story? Yes. And to me, the best films are all about telling the best stories, right? And I think he does that. So I'm going to say, I'll give it a 90. And only because of the weeping. Only because of Peter's crying. It really just threw me off.
Lost him 10%.
Yeah, lost 10%. Everything else. But I'm just like, I understand you're supposed to be a teenager. But he calls her mommy as well. I don't. Maybe that's him trying to go back to the childhood he never had with her because I don't know. But yeah, I'll give it a very solid 90. Yep.
What about wine?
Well, I don't think wine was the right drink for this movie. Because I don't think you can do it. I don't think you can do wine to this movie. So I will give this movie, because it's so big. This might be a cop out. I don't know. There's a brewery in Virginia, and I've done work for them when I was working at CW, called the Devil's Backbone. This movie gets their hardest stuff. I don't know what their hardest stuff is, but it gets the Devil's Backbone because of the nature of this movie, the intensity of this movie. I think it deserves everything that it gets because it's fantastic. How about yourself?
I am also going to have a bit of a cop out. So there were like words that were on the walls that Charlie had written that are just very weird, like either Hebrew or some sort of like creepy omen sounding word. A lot of them had a meaning that was like release the devil or something. So I just picked a wine that kind of sounded like that, which is a Zweigelt wine. And I could just imagine that being on the wall. It's just an Austrian red wine. And it also has like cranberry and tart cherry and peppery notes. So I'm not sure what those have to do with it, but it kind of sounds like a wine that I would imagine being on the wall. And I'd be like, that sounds horrible. Like that sounds horrifying. It probably means something super dark and scary. So,
and the fact that it's a little bit unknown even now,
that's fair.
Like I still don't know everything about this movie. So I think that fits perfectly. I guess it's about time to spin that wheel.
Let's spin it.
Let's hope for something big on our 10th episode. Here we go. So we asked our production team for something big, and they have absolutely delivered. We are going to do our first ever comparison. And we are comparing Space Jam to Space Jam. It is currently, at the time of this recording, available on HBO Max. It will not be by the time you hear this episode or that episode. So we
are
doing...
watch it now before you hear us telling you to go watch it now.
So we are doing 2001 Space Jam, A New Legacy, directed by Malcolm D. Lee, versus the original Space Jam from 1996, directed by Joe... Pitka, it is. I am interested. I'm, of course, you know, kid of the 90s. I'm a huge fan of the original Space Jam, as I think everybody is. And I have yet to see the new Space Jam. So I'm very excited to compare and contrast these two hopeful cult masterpieces. So I will say at this point, grab your secret sauce
and your Bill Murray basketball jersey
and meet
and
me.
Let's go to Looneyville or something.
Just the worst thing ever.
This has been Cinema Sommelier. I'm Zachary Wachaleski.
I am Gary T. Moore.
Join us next time for Taste Test 2 Movies.